Good evening, everyone. This is David Seeloff and with the Byte Show, and George Ann Hughes, her voice isn't doing so well today, so I'm just going to continue and do Chapter 7 of The Star That Astonished the World, The Star of Bethlehem, from Dr. Ernest L. Martin. And this is at askelm.com, where you can find the entire book and other books complete online on the ASK website. And it's also listed, the ASK website is also listed under my name listing for on the Byte Show. So we're going to get right into Chapter 7, titled The Dark Decade in History by Ernest L. Martin. Okay, I'm going to start reading. It is evident that the chronological indications in the Bible clearly point to 3 B.C. for the nativity of Jesus. While this is the case for the Bible, what about the secular records that have come down to us from ancient times? Do they support this time as the proper period for Jesus' birth? The answer is yes. However, one thing must be kept in mind about the secular records that describe this period. Historians are well aware that they are very obscure. In fact, the decade in which Jesus was born is one of the least documented that we have for the entire period of the Roman Empire. Now, it is well known among classical historians who specialize in the early period of the Roman Empire that the decade from 6 BC to 4 AD is one of the most nebulous in the history of Rome. It is a common lament among Roman historians that this 10-year period, one of the most important in the history of Western civilization, as a matter of fact, bristles with many historical and chronological difficulties because of the garbled or imperfect records that have come down to us. Professor Timothy Barnes rightly states that, quote, the year of Tiberius' retirement from public life is one of the most obscure, the years of Tiberius' retirement from public life are one of the most obscure decades in the history of the Roman Empire. And this is in Timothy Barnes' Journal of Roman Studies from 1974, page 22. And Sir Ronald Syme echoed the same sentiment when he spoke about the, quote, hazards inherent in the obscure decade of 6 BC to 4 AD. And this is Sir Ronald Syme in his book, The Crisis of 2 BC. If there was ever a dark decade in the history of Rome, this is one. And sadly, this lack of information occurs at the very time the historian who specializes in the time of Augustus Caesar and the birth of Christ needs it most. A great deal of confusion emerges within and among the historical records, and this is no exaggeration. It would be appropriate to note the sad difficulties that classical historians encounter regarding this 10-year period. One problem involves the records of Velleius Paterculus, or Paterculus, who covers this period of time. The fact is, Velleius is deficient in giving information from 6 BC to 4 AD. Note the remarks of Sir Ronald Syme. Quote, The name Velleius brings up the multiple inadequacies of the ancient sources for the decade during which Tiberius was absent from political life in Rome. By what he says and by what he suppresses, by lavish laudation and dishonest distraction, this writer, meaning Velleius, puts Tiberius on exhibit as the unique general, the indispensable custos vindereque imperii, the predestined successor to Augustus Caesar, end quote. Once again, this is in Ronald Syme's The Crisis of 2 BC. So there are difficulties with secular records of this period. The inadequacies of Velleius are not the only illustration of the sad state of affairs in understanding the history and chronology of this decade. Other authors are also lacking. Syme continues, quote, Chance conspires with design to the same sad effect. There are gaps in the text of Cassius Dio between 6 BC and 4 AD. In three places, two folia are missing from the manuscript. Hence, notable transactions are truncated, garbled, or lost to knowledge. It is hardly possible to work out a satisfactory narrative, in other words, a narrative of events for that period of time. Mere paraphrase or amalgamation is not enough. Investigation of this obscure decade calls for various resources, and rational conjecture cannot be dispensed with, end quote. And once again, Ronald Syme, Crisis of 2 BC. Well, what are some of the problems with Cassio Dio, a historian of that period? The manuscripts that contain his writings give historical information for the years 70 BC to 70 AD, roughly a 140-year period. But he leaves out the years 4 and 3 BC, and we have only part of what happened in 2 BC. In actual fact, from 10 BC onward, his work is probably an abridgment of an 11th century scholar, because we have quotes from Cassius Dio in other works that do not occur in the abridgment from 10 BC onward. Worse yet, the abridgment itself is clearly defective because it has Cassius mentioning that Gaius Caesar, who was also known as Caligula, assumed the toga of manhood in 5 BC. And then he makes the chronological absurdity that Lucius, Gaius Caesar's brother, received the same thing after a lapse of a year in 4 BC. But we know from the writings of Augustus himself that Lucius received the toga virilis in 2 BC. And this is according to Augustus' own writings. The imperfect state of the historical records regarding the decade in which Jesus was born ought to evoke caution among some theologians in their interpretation of chronological and historical matters at this time. It is certainly no time to express dogmatism on chronological questions. But strangely and sadly, this is the very time that dogmatism is expressed. As you'll notice, as an aside, Georgianne is here. She's running the desk. She's on the phone, by the way, but she's just not speaking. But as a matter of fact, this is the way it is with science. When scientists don't know something, that's when they appear to be dogmatic. Same with historians, same with theologians, same with archaeologists and anthropologists. And it's amazing that some of the sciences where the least amount is known, the greatest amount of speculation and dogmatism is expressed. So that's an aside. But as Dr. Martin said, it's certainly no time to express dogmatism on chronological matters, but this is the very time that dogmatism is expressed. Caution is normally thrown to the wind in most encyclopedias and historical works regarding the time of Christ's nativity. It is usually assumed, without the slightest question or tinge of doubt, that Jesus was born before 4 BC. And this appraisal is looked upon as an infallible judgment by most modern theologians. But it's in full contradiction to the writings of the early Christian scholars, who were much closer to the time period, who say that Jesus was born after 4 BC. And this is well expressed in detail in Jack Finnegan's Handbook of Biblical Chronology. And this book, well within the past 5 years or 7 years, has come out with a newer edition available in most major libraries. But why do most theologians insist on a year before 4 BC, sometimes as early as 5, 6, 7, and now some as early as 12 BC? Those years are even suggested for the birth of Jesus. The common belief centers on remarks made by Josephus regarding the death of King Herod the Great. he mentions that there was an eclipse of the moon not long before the death of Herod. Now, lunar eclipses occur rather often, and there was such an eclipse in March 13th, 4 BC. This is the lunar eclipse that most scholars select as the one associated with the death of Herod. Still, there are other lunar eclipses near that time, and these must be considered also. The remarks of Josephus about a lunar eclipse are important, but they must be interpreted within the framework of a proper understanding of the history of the time. The records of Josephus are even vital, but they must be examined and applied prudently, or else confusion will continue to reign concerning the time of Christ's birth. Now, there are anomalies in the works of Josephus, and one must be very careful in evaluating the records of Josephus. He is not an easy author to understand in matters dealing with chronology. At times he seems consistent in what he relates, and at other times he is absurdly inconsistent. As a matter of fact, for certain periods he avoids giving chronological details at the very time the historian needs the most. For example, the main years of Archelaus, the successor of King Herod, his son, Archelaus, are glossed over with one or two general statements, and the period from 6 AD to the time of Pilate is practically blank in the writings of Josephus. For some strange reason, the 20-year period just prior to the ministry of Jesus is glossed over as not being of necessary worth to report. And this applies to both major works of Josephus, both the Antiquities of the Jews and the Wars of the Jews, both major historical works. The lacunae are a deliberate glossing over by Josephus, probably for political reasons. There are also anomalies in Josephus' treatment of King Herod's reign. In the first 5 years of Herod's kingship, Josephus buttresses his history with known and reliable chronological eras of time. He equated Herod's seventh year with the year following the Battle of Actium between Augustus on one side. It was part of the Civil War, with Augustus on one side and Antony and Cleopatra on the other. Well, King Herod Josephus dates King Herod's seventh year to the year following that battle where Augustus defeated Antony and Cleopatra. Josephus also gave reference to the Olympiads, a reasonably well-known international chronological benchmark. Josephus continued to give such exact dates until King Herod's 28th year, just a few years before the birth of Jesus. And this is in Josephus' Antiquities. Now, but from then on, for some unexplained reason, Josephus stopped giving chronological indications which would link the later years of Herod's reign with known historical eras. He did not resume his normal international cross-references until the 10th year of Archelaus, son of Herod, in 6 AD. And from then on until the Jewish War of 66 to 73 AD, his chronicle references are then sensible and, numerous. So why did Josephus abandon internationally recognized chronological references from 9 BC to 6 AD? No one knows. But this very period of time is when Roman historians are sadly saddled with deficient chronological evidence for what was happening in the Roman Empire. Some of the most interesting events in Palestinian and Roman history occurred during that period of 16 years. But for all those years, not one historical event mentioned by Josephus is cross-referenced, to the Olympiads, the Battle of Actium, the years of the Roman consuls, or to the year of Caesar's reign. Those and other factors have caused historians to suspect the motives of Josephus in his writings of history. The German scholar Stauffer, in his Ethelbert Stauffer, in his book Jesus and His Story, on page 22, has summed up some of the problems in accepting Josephus without a critical eye. Quote, "The past 50 years of research on the work of Josephus have taught us to be severely critical of his method and presentation. Josephus had an axe to grind. His historical journalism was intended as a self-defense and a self-aggrandizement. He wrote to glorify his people and to eulogize the Roman Empire. He was an ardent sympathizer with the pro-Roman collaborationists among the Jews, and an opponent of all the anti-Roman and anti-Herodian partisans of the Palestinian resistance movement. Crucial parts of Josephus' historical works, moreover, were casually patched together from older sources of uneven value. Consequently, they were replete with gaps and contradictions. They are muddled and misleading, and this is particularly true in his remarks on Augustus, King Herod, Quirinius, who was proconsul of Syria during a very important section of time regarding Christ's birth, and the census. Of course, Josephus remains an invaluable source, but he is not to be read uncritically." End quote. Now, long ago, Edersheim, in his valuable analysis of Josephus in the Dictionary of Christian Biography, written in 1882, compiled in 1882, Edersheim recorded a panoply of contradictions from one part of Josephus to another. Edersheim wrote, quote, "Discrepancies are not wanting between statements in Antiquities and others in the Jewish War, and even mistakes in regard to plain biblical facts. This is, end quote. And this is especially true in chronological matters. So there are chronological errors in Josephus. So every chronological point that Josephus makes has to be verified and checked out, which is good if you can do so. So, continuing on with Dr. Martin's text, "There can be no doubt of Josephus' chronological errors. As one example out of many, note his appraisal of the first year of Cyrus the Great. In the Jewish Wars, he said the year was what is recognized today, if you convert the numbers, to 570 B.C., but in one part of his Antiquities, he said it was 578 B.C. And in still another, he said it was in 586 B.C. In reality, most historians today feel that the year was actually 538 B.C. Not only was Josephus inconsistent in his own references, he was wrong in all of them that he mentioned regarding Cyrus the Great. One might excuse Josephus for mistaking chronological matters some six centuries before his time, but it should be expected that he would fare better in periods much nearer his own lifetime. Yet at the very time of King Herod, during whose reign Jesus was born, at the last two years, Professor Corbishley, some 50 years ago, shows that the writings of Josephus contain much evidence of a deeper corruption than many seem to suspect. Everyone who has gone into the subject at all is aware that there are obvious blunders in the chronology of Josephus, with no successful attempt to remedy them, appears to have been made. And this is in Corbishley, Journal of Roman Studies, volume 36. A few examples can be given. Josephus made the statement that Herod's government over Galilee, the northern part of his kingdom, began when he was very young. Quote, very young. When he was, quote, 15 years of age, end quote. This is in Antiquities, book 14. Hardly anyone today accepts this statement of Josephus as accurate. Some even want to correct the text to read age 25. However, Professor Marcus, who helped translate the Loeb edition of Josephus, the Loeb translation of Josephus, relates that 15 is certainly the genuine reading. Josephus must have said 13, otherwise how could Herod be described as very young? There's not the slightest textual authority for changing the 15 to 25, and still Josephus was wrong. Herod was certainly in his 20s when he became governor of Galilee, or else he could hardly have been nearly 70 years old, as Josephus later attests, at his death. This does not end Josephus' chronological anomaly. This does not end Josephus' chronological anomalies. He tells us that Herod's appointment as king was in the 184th Olympiad, which was inaccurate by a few months with his next reference, which said that it took place when Calvinus and Pollio were consuls, and this occurred in 40 BC. However, a close inspection of what Josephus stated and comparing it with other Roman records, we find that Herod was actually made king in the spring of 38 BC, not in 40. That's not all. Cassius Dio said that Herod captured Jerusalem in 38 BC. While some scholars think Josephus identified its capitulation in the year of 37 BC, in the first part of that of a sentence, and in the latter part of the same sentence, Josephus indicates it was in 36 BC. Well, these contradictions have given modern historians considerable difficulty in arriving at chronological exactitudes from Josephus. And this is covered completely in the notes of the Loeb edition of Josephus, which is also available at any major library. Even the standard dating systems of Josephus are unclear. Josephus appears not to have understood how to date events in Palestine with the Olympiad dating system, because he was notoriously in error in several places when he attempted to utilize it. But there are other problems with Josephus' chronological statements. Relative to King Herod's death, the modern historians Vermesh and Millar feel that, quote, Josephus reckons 1 year too many, end quote, which would put his death in 3 BC. But if the year 36 BC was the year that Herod captured Jerusalem, as some historians believe, and the cycle of sabbatical years, as shown in history, certainly reveal this to be the true year, Herod's last year of life would have been from 2 to 1 BC, and this is the truth. Indeed, in Antiquities, Book 14, Section 490, Josephus said that the Hasmonean reign ended after a rule of 126 years. But it was actually a reign of 128 years, if one reckons 164 BC as the start of the Maccabean rule. In Antiquities, Josephus stated that Hyrcanus was 81 years old at his death, but historians clearly realize that Hyrcanus was in his early 70s when he was killed. In Antiquities, Book 15, 181, Josephus related that the interval between Pompey's restoration of Hyrcanus to power and the time of Antigonus' usurpation was more than 40 years. But that span of time was actually only 23 years through other chronological sources. In Antiquities, Book 15, Josephus said that Mariamne was executed in late late in 29 BC. But in his Wars of the Jews, Book 1, Josephus said that it was in 34 BC. There is even more confusion in the works of Josephus at the very period where we need accurate chronological information. In two places, Josephus wrote that Archelaus, Herod's successor, his son, reigned 10 years. But in another place, he said it was 9 years. He also recorded that Archelaus married Galphira, wife of King Juba of Mauritania, after Juba died. But he was clearly in error. And it's well known that Juba was alive about 20 years after Archelaus married Galphira. These chronological inconsistencies should cause modern historians to tread cautiously when they come to evaluate what Josephus recorded. But they go merrily on their way of dogmatism when it comes to Josephus' statements concerning the number of years for King Herod's reign. The truth is, Josephus himself, when he was not an eyewitness to historical events and relying on the statements of earlier historians, did not always understand the chronological facts. He often gave two or three different dates for certain events in his different works, and sometimes all of his indications do not accord with modern chronological tables. Josephus also leaves out important persons. One thing is for certain. Josephus was a very subjective writer. In his own words, he admitted that the writing of his autobiography was to assure his Roman benefactors that he was thoroughly pro-Roman in every respect. This is in the Life of Josephus, Numbers 424 to 428 to 429. His loyalty to Rome went so far as that he identified the prophesied Messiah of the Old Testament as being Vespasian, the Roman emperor. So that's ridiculous. He wrote this in The Wars of the Jews, Book 4, Number 622. And at another point, it has amazed Jewish scholars that Josephus did not say one word about the most important rabbi from the close of the Old Testament period until modern times, Hillel the First. This rabbi was most prominent in Jewish affairs, and he lived at the exact time of Josephus' silence on chronological matters. Josephus full well knew of Hillel's prestige. Indeed, he mentioned that Simon, one of Hillel's descendants, was of a very distinguished stock. And distinguished he was. The Hillel that Josephus refused to write about was no less than the originator of rabbinic Judaism that has become the mainstream of Judaic thought ever since. Hillel was reputed to have been in charge of the Sanhedrin, which was the Jewish Supreme Court. He was so important that later Jews considered him to be equal to Ezra, the reputed canonizer of the Old Testament itself. Hardly anyone was more important to Judaic theology from the writing of King Herod until modern times. But if we had only the writings of Josephus to go on, no one would even know that Hillel existed. Such avoidance has to be looked on as an attempt on the part of Josephus to avoid comment because of biased opinions. This may be the reason why he recorded so little about Jesus and his times, in addition to Hillel. The truth is, Josephus may have tried to give a reasonable appraisal of certain historical events, but it is what he left out, or gave no chronological indications about, that gives us of modern times problems in understanding what actually happened at this crucial period of time. There are good reasons for Josephus to adopt his subjective approach. To be frank, he was interested in keeping the top part of his anatomy attached to the bottom parts. And to stay alive, Josephus had to watch very carefully what he wrote. Had he been too plain in his writing, not only would he have been in jeopardy of losing his life, but his historical works would have gone up in smoke as well. He must have felt it prudent to judiciously avoid giving comment on certain crucial periods, and especially to the mention of some key individuals, because the political climate in Rome at the time he wrote did not warrant plain speaking, and one could hardly blame him. And worse yet, there's considerable evidence that the manuscripts that we have of Josephus have been edited. Although it has been generally accepted that Josephus did write about Jesus of Nazareth in his book Antiquities, in Antiquities of the Jews, book 18, number 63 to 64, it is felt by many scholars that there have been some alterations to the text to give a favorable account of Jesus as being the Christ, the Messiah. The notes in the Loeb edition of Josephus give the pros and cons of the issue in a fair and concise manner. What this section does is indicate is the fact that there have been editings in the text of Josephus by later individuals, and one must be careful in accepting all the statements of Josephus, especially those involving chronological matters where numerical indications are in the text. The fact is, there are manuscripts of Josephus which show variations in the number of years in which important rulers lived and reigned. One of the most important of these vagaries is in regard to the death of Philip, the son of Herod. Josephus said he ruled 37 years. But note this. The earliest copies of the manuscripts of Josephus show him dying in the 22nd year of Tiberius. And since Tiberius' 22nd year was 36 AD, this shows that Philip began his reign in 1 BC. At the very time, Dr. Martin says that I am showing in this book that the father, Herod, died. With modern manuscripts of Josephus copied since the year 1700 AD, it is common to erroneously read, quote, the 20th year and not the proper 22nd. In order to confirm what the various manuscripts of Josephus do, in fact, state on this matter, David W. Beyer of San Diego, California, made a survey of all the major manuscripts of Josephus in the British Museum, plus referring to others in the libraries of Europe, and found that before 1700 CE, 27 of the manuscripts of the British Museum have the correct rendering 22nd instead of 20, and only 3 manuscripts have the 20. But note this, when one consults manuscripts produced before 1544 AD, some 25 manuscripts, all of them have the number 22. And, of course, as Dr. Martin notes, this yields to an ascension year of 1 BC for King Herod's son. Beyer has come to the conclusion that the number 22 is the correct figure that Josephus wrote. Only in the year 1544 did the spurious 20 come into vogue, and there's no doubt that the number 22 is what Josephus wrote. Indeed, Beyer methodically has reconstructed the manuscript history of these two different numbers regarding King Herod's death, as shown in the manuscripts of Josephus. And to his credit, Beyer has done it in a most reasonable way. And this is in a paper delivered by Beyer called Josephus Reexamined, Unraveling the 22nd Year of Tiberius, presented at the Near East Archaeological Society, or at the Society for Biblical Literature. So important is Beyer's work in this matter, in giving the real manuscript evidence for the 22nd year of Tiberius for Philip's death, that Professor John Dominic Crossan asked that Beyer present his research at the Historical Jesus section of the Society for Biblical Literature meeting in Philadelphia in November 1955. And Beyer is to be congratulated for presenting a survey of the manuscripts of Josephus in this matter. The survey was long overdue, but Mr. Beyer has now accomplished the job for the scholarly world. What this early manuscript evidence of Josephus shows is the fact that Herod did die in 1 BC, and that Philip, his son, commenced his reign at the death of Herod in 1 BC. That coordinates precisely with the historical records that show what what I present in this book, Dr. Martin says. And continues, I am thankful to Mr. Beyer for his painstaking research into the manuscripts that show this fact. Now, the editing of later scribes also gives problems to interpreting Josephus. These difficulties that I have been showing reveal that one must be careful in accepting historical data, especially those items involving chronology that we find in the present manuscripts of Josephus. Every statement of Josephus must be critically evaluated. This is because there is no doubt that the texts of Josephus have been tampered with by later scribes who have wanted to improve the statements of Josephus in matters that disagree with their own theories. This does not mean that the writings of Josephus should be abandoned, but it shows that one must weigh his historical and chronological statements that have come down to us in the manuscripts with a great deal of caution, and they must be counter-checked with other sources. We must realize that Josephus has given us a great deal of valuable information, but his statements must be judiciously tested for their veracity. Josephus is especially good when he records what he saw as an eyewitness. His account of the Jewish-Roman War of 66 to 70 AD is an excellent and forthright account of the events, and most historians give him credit for being reasonably objective. But when it comes to historical events before he was born, Josephus then becomes much less reliable. Even what we find in the manuscripts may not be what Josephus actually wrote, and this could account for his many inconsistencies. The period we are discussing in this book is one of those difficult times in understanding chronological matters. One must exercise caution in the reading of Josephus, especially in chronological affairs from about 9 BC to 6 AD. We do not know why Josephus in that period neglected to give cross-references to internationally recognized eras of time, but he was negligent. And this is precisely where our problem lies. Not only are the records from Roman historians very deficient in this period of time, it was when that dark decade was in effect, but in addition, Josephus himself fails us when it comes to precise chronological indications. And it's no wonder that historians are confused regarding the time of Jesus' birth. Now remember, Josephus died in 95 or 100 AD. So, he was not exactly sure when he was born. I'm not exactly sure. It might be in the text. In the first and third chapters of his book, attention was drawn to the historical opinions in the first and third chapters of this book, Dr. Martin says, attention was drawn to the historical opinions of early Christian scholars who lived from the 2nd to the 6th centuries. I have shown that the majority placed the birth of Jesus in a period that we now recognize as 3 to 2 BC, and this is indeed the very period in which Christ was born. This is important testimony, and it should be seriously considered by modern historians. But in spite of this, we do not want to give the impression that the early scholars were always correct. The early Christian scholars, that is. And this is because some say that Jesus was born in 3 BC, others in 2 BC, and even in 1 BC. Even they are inconsistent in their precise datings as to the exact year. Yet importantly, they are all consistent in showing that Jesus was certainly born after 4 BC and not before 4 BC that scholars dogmatize about today. And this is a significant point, and it is of utmost importance in discovering the time of Jesus' birth. One, however, might ask why the early Christian scholars were not in unanimity regarding the year of Christ, of Jesus' birth, though all knew that it occurred after 4 BC. Well, this is not difficult to explain. The records they had to consult were written at different times and at different places in the Roman Empire. And, of course, each of the Christian scholars had different access to the different resources. The records they had to consult were written at different times and different places in the Roman Empire, as I said. Besides, the application of internationally used chronological indicators, such as Olympiads, the Battle of Actium, the Consuls of Rome, etc., many ancient historians simply gave dates according to the years of certain kings. Some kings reckon their years from the day they took office, others from the year they were crowned, and there are numerous ways of doing this, as we've discovered earlier in earlier presentations. Other dating systems involve the eras of cities or states, and these often differed among various peoples who lived at the same time over the Roman Empire. In other words, chronological indications of early historians, and often when faithfully recorded, were scarcely understood by later scholars who lived in other areas of the world but did not use their time reckoning systems. It is entirely conceivable why the early Christian historians might have been as much as 1, 2, or even 3 years off in reckoning the time of Jesus' birth. Even Josephus was in error in the same way for the time of Herod when he used such Gentile dating systems. Now, what is the present state of affairs in sorting out the problems involving the understanding of the time of Jesus' birth? Things now have gone from bad to worse. Sheer bedlam presently reigns among modern scholars who specialize in these chronological matters. The wide differences of opinion of scholars are so askew from one another that the variety of their theories becomes almost laughable when their conclusions are compared with one another. Indeed, it would be laughable if the subject were not so serious. Look at the confusion that now exists in the scholarly world about the birth of Jesus. In a book entitled Chronos Kairos Christos, published in 1989 by the prestigious firm of Eisenbrown's as a festschrift in honor of one of the finest chronologists of our day, Professor Jack Finnegan, the two editors, Dr. Jerry Vardaman and Dr. Edwin Yamauchi, included articles of research from some of the top scholars today in the field of chronology regarding the time of Jesus' nativity. Both Vardaman and Yamauchi must be congratulated for having the courage to publish the various articles, because almost all of them are contradictory to one another in many of their essential factors. The disunity among the scholars, as shown in this book, is so wide in their evaluation of the historical sources that the only reasonable word to describe the state of scholarly affairs is indeed chaos, which is, confusion presently reigns among scholars. The laity need to know about the chaos that presently prevails in the professional research now being conducted. The book Chronos, Kairos, and Christos does the job of showing this chaos, and one should be thankful for its candor. But look at what we find. In this single book, the Chronos, Kairos, Christos, one scholar argues that Jesus was born sometime between August to October of 12 BC, and that he was crucified at the Passover in 21 AD. 21 AD, of all things. Another, using different research as his basis of evaluation, also accepted the 12 BC birth for Jesus, but he felt the record showed Jesus' crucifixion was in 36 AD. Another thinks Jesus was born in January of 7 BC, and that the Magi visited him while he was a young toddler and standing by his father on November 12th, 7 BC. Another suggests that Jesus was born in late 5 BC and his crucifixion was in 33 AD. My research is also contained in this book, and he shows his reason. Dr. Martin shows his reasons for believing that Jesus was born in 3 BC and crucified in 30 AD. Now remember, all of these diverse conclusions from the top scholars from various universities occur in one book. This ought to show the state of confusion that presently exists on the whole issue. The attempt that I presently make in this book is to bring a reasonable amount of pragmatism and common sense to the chaos that now reigns among scholars. Dr. Martin writes that he believes that this book that you are now reading does that very thing. His contention is that the lunar eclipse that Josephus said was associated with Herod's death was that of 10 January 1 BC, and not the earlier eclipse of 13 March 4 BC. And there are other modern historians who feel the same way, notably W.E. Filmer, Ormond Edwards, and especially the important work of the classical scholar Dr. Paul Kerestes in his two-volume work written in 1989 entitled Imperial Rome and the Christians. This latter work provides some outstanding research throughout its pages. It shows the reasonableness of accepting the basic premises on the death of Herod in 1 BC that Dr. Martin is advocating in this book. And we are not the only ones who have understood the historical records in this fashion. Scaliger, as early as the 16th century AD, was very decisive in stating that Herod's death was associated with the eclipse of 10 January 1 BC. He was supported by the German historian Calvisius, who recorded some 300 eclipses as chronological benchmarks for reckoning historical events in the past. In the last century, the English scholars William Galloway, H. Bosanquet, and C. R. Condor also affirmed that the 10 January 1 BC eclipse was the proper one. Professors Kaspari and Race of Germany also maintained this belief in their chronological studies. So in the next chapter, we will find that Josephus, in spite of his chronological errors, provides eyewitness information from Nicholas of Damascus, which can prove the time of Herod's death. And that time has to be from January 1 BC. And that time, King Herod's death has to be in January 1 BC. This will place Jesus' nativity in 3 to 2 BC, years earlier, a couple of years earlier, of course, before King Herod's death. The astronomy is the key to understand Josephus. When we apply the rules of astronomy with history, we find that the dark decade in Roman history, which has caused so much confusion to scholars, becomes full of light and understanding. And so concludes Dr. Martin's Chapter 7, The Dark Decade in History. So I'm going to wrap it up now, and I will mention one thing that occurred to me the other day. is it's interesting that we never find any writings of Isaac Newton regarding the birth of Christ, anything substantial. And it's also interesting that Isaac Newton wrote more on the Bible than he did on science. And he was also a person who was very interested in astrology. It is surprising to me that Newton's work would not have come across the truth of what Dr. Martin has located in his book, The Star That Astonished the World. But it's an interesting thing, and I wonder if someday some indications, I don't know if anybody looking at Newton's work with the understanding of Dr. Martin's book might not be able to see, and unfortunately Newton wrote in code sometimes, so not all of that's been cracked, is my understanding. So that, you know, Isaac Newton, one of the premier minds of this age or any other age, may have had that correct information. As Dr. Martin noted, other people have noted the correct year of King Herod's death. And then working from the scripture, you should come to a reasonable conclusion as to Jesus' birth. But even modern scholars and ancient scholars and even ancient Christian scholars who knew Greek, none of them seem to key on Revelation chapter, especially the early Christian scholars, none of them seem to key on or understand that Revelation chapter 12, verses 1 and 2 to 5, were astronomical indications of time regarding the birth of Christ. That appears to be a unique find of Dr. Ernest Martin that I have yet to see anywhere else that anyone else has come across. Nor do other people promote it or use it. Indeed, there are people going around now who, you know, as hobbyists, there's about five people that go around using Dr. Martin's scenario more or less, and some even quote him, and some just use the material and don't quote him, who, you know, use this material, but none of them that I know of cite the, I mean, they give lectures and to groups and church groups around the country, but none of them that I know of use the Revelation 12 verses 1 to 5 as a time indicator that it certainly would appear to be once it's explained, as Dr. Martin has explained it in previous chapters. So we're going to close, and this is the end of Chapter 7, The Dark Decade in History. So thank you very much, Georgianne, and keep Georgianne in your prayers and your thoughts, both now during her present voice distress as well as at other times, because she needs your support to keep the Bite Show going you know, to continue to put out understanding of the world and the scriptures from many sources, not just ASK. So thank you, Georgianne, and thank you, everyone. Good night.